Up next, we have Lynn Gould, is the Managing Director of the Just Health Action, JHA, a nonprofit organization in Seattle that advocates for reducing health inequities that result from social, political, economic, and cultural factors. Using an empowerment of education model, JHA teaches classes and workshops that review the evidence and then facilitates discussions and consensus on how individuals and communities can take action to improve health. Lynn also works as a consultant to advise communities on health, environmental, and environmental justice issues.
And it's the mouth. Sorry, it's the mouth, not the.
Oh, I'm so glad you told me that.
So, it's probably already popular hour. I'm okay with everyone like standing up and stretching and
sort of whatever. Okay, so this is going to be an interesting story because it could be three presentations, and I've put three presentations all into one, so I hope that you understand what's going on. But I have a co-author right here, Bill Daniel from the University of Washington, and then BJ Cummings, who's also an author, couldn't be here today. I get it. Okay, no relationships to disclose. So today I'm going to talk about the Duwamish Valley, which is an industrial valley just south of, it's part of Seattle, but it's just part of, south of Seattle. And then I'm going to talk about our three-pronged approach, healthy communities approach, and then I'm going to talk about the successes, challenges, and recommendations. So for those of you who aren't from Seattle, Washington, this is looking south towards beautiful Mount Rainier on a beautiful day, and downtown Seattle's on the left, and then Elliott Bay is part of Puget Sound. And the Duwamish River is, I think, about an 80-mile river that starts from the Cascades and empties into Elliott Bay. And it's the most industrialized part of Seattle. It's 5,000 acres zoned industrial, 80% of Seattle's industrial land base, 80,000 family wage jobs. However, there's just gigantic legacy of, you know, contamination in soils, groundwater, air, surface water, sediments, et cetera. And in addition, the Duwamish River was declared a Superfund site in 2001, and it's 5 miles long, 441 acres of contaminated sediments from industry and stormwater runoff, and the contaminants are mostly in the mud, in the benthic organisms, and then they bioaccumulate up the food chain. So the pollutants, there's more than 40 pollutants that exceed Washington state standards. But the ones that are of most concern are arsenic, PCBs, dioxins, and carcinogenic PAHs. There's health advisories all up and down the river saying don't eat the resident fish or seafood and do not swim in the river after stormwater events. There's also two residential communities that live in the Duwamish Valley. One community is called South Park. And they're just the south, they live on the south side of the Duwamish River, and despite the fact that they're exposed to a lot of contamination, they have assets. And some of their assets are they have a community center, they have a clinic, they have this really, really awesome farm, but they also have these other problems. Georgetown is also on the Duwamish River, but it's north of the Duwamish River, and Well, the old King County Airport used to be there. We now have the SeaTac Airport, but this airport is still a very, very, very active airport. Boeing and FedEx and UPS and all of these other planes, come in and out of it. And so there's a lot of noise from from that neighborhood, and then there's also air pollution. So there's Duwamish Valley health disparities. There's all of these are statistically significant, but Duwamish Valley, 18% people below the poverty line compared to King County average of around 10%. Asthma hospitalization rate is huge, 240 per 100,000 compared to 143 per 100,000 for King County. Assault is a problem. So there's just all of these issues in the valley. So I'm going to use the environmental justice definition used by Robert Bullard, and he basically says the environment is everything. It's where we live, it's where we work, it's where we play, it's where we pray, it's where we go to school, it's everything. And the reason why this is really important is that environmental justice in some ways traditionally was just defined as kind of an environmental contamination issue, but it's grown much more, and there's this huge connection between the social determinants of health and environmental justice, and that is really what this presentation is, where we're going with that presentation, or with mine. So this is the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition back in 2009, you know, met with all these residents and said, well, what do you want the Duwamish Valley to look like? If you had the perfect, you know, vision of the valley. And they came up with this map, this book that they wrote. It's on the web. It has won multiple awards. And health was a main outcome. And so the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, which is basically an environmentally oriented coalition organization of 10, it's 10 nonprofit organizations that work together as a coalition, they said, wow, we just need to start working on getting, instead of environmental grants, we need to do health plus environment to really take action to improve the health of the community. And so we got three projects all at once. One, the research part is called the Cumulative Health Impacts Analysis, otherwise known as CHIA. It's funded by the EPA Environmental Justice Grant. Then we've got a policy component, and it's a health impact assessment funded by the Pew Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And then we have an action component also funded by the CARE EPA. It's Community Action for Renewed Environment and funded by, as I said, EPA. So I'm just going to explain the three prongs and who's running what, because sometimes it's really confusing. So we've got the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, who I just described, and they're the lead on the research prong, the action prong, and they're working on the policy prong. And then I run a nonprofit organization that works on health inequalities, research and health inequities, and I teach health equity workshops. And so they've got me in there to do the research on how you integrate the environmental justice part with the health part. And then we have Bill Daniel over here, and he's from the School of Public Health, the Environmental Health Division, and he's kind of environmental justice dude extraordinaire. And he's the lead on the health impact assessment. So now I'm going to tell you about CHIA, the Cumulative Health Impacts Assessment, the research part. Here's a definition that we use that we got from Cal EPA. Any exposures, public health, or environmental effects from the combined emission and discharges in a geographic area, including environmental pollution from all sources, whether single or multiple media, routinely, accidentally, or otherwise released. This is really, really important because when you think about contaminated waste sites and how we clean up contaminated waste sites, we always do these things called risk assessments, and they're contaminant specific. And the important thing about a cumulative health impact is that we're like taking all of the health impacts, we're looking at all the social determinants of health and putting them together and figuring out what the real health issues are. But before we did our research, we actually had a community-based participatory research part. And that was going out into the community and finding out what their health issues were. And we used the community experts to find out what their issues are. So we first did a traditional survey run by the community. But the second part that was most exciting was that they developed this mapping exercise. And it's basically two maps. And this is an example of Paulina Lopez, who is one of our experts, our CDPR experts, and it's two pictures of Georgetown, and one of them in both Spanish and English says, what makes Georgetown healthy? And then the second map is what makes Georgetown unhealthy. And so you're not only documenting what the issues are, but where the issues are, so for action purposes. So for the CHIA research part, we can't just look up, we can take a look at the health impacts in the area in the Duwamish River and see how people are, how sick, whether they have health issues or not, but we need to compare it. So we had a geographic unit of analysis and we used 10 zip codes, and we wish we could have used more zip codes, but we didn't have enough money. But what we did, we picked these zip codes based on ranges of, we used the environmental justice definition, so we looked at ranges of income, ranges of minority populations, and then ranges of pollution in these 10 zip codes, and then we used indicators from the CDPR surveys. So, okay, this is my most complicated slide. So there's a formula, and I can show it to you at the end if you want, but there's a cumulative health impacts formula, and it has five components. And the five components are socioeconomic factors, sensitive population factors, environmental exposure factors, environmental effects factors, and public health factors. Okay? Now, what you can do is you have indicators that can go into each of those components. And what we ended up doing was picking the indicators that, one, fit the environmental justice definition, and then, two, were indicators that the community wanted us to pick. And so these are the indicators that we picked. And you'll see, like, environmental effects factors. We picked park area because they complained that they didn't have enough places to go play. Tree canopy, because we know there wasn't enough trees, and we know that trees help reduce air pollution, particulate matter. So those are the types of things that went in to the formula. So here's the results. So the brown area is the area, Georgetown South Park area, okay? So the cumulative impact score goes from 6 to 120, with 120 being bad and 6 being low. All right, so the Georgetown South Park area got a score of 106. The next score after that was 66. And that 66, just FYI, it actually doesn't have very much environmental contamination at all, but it's a historically red line district. Huge, you know, restrictive covenants, high minorities, low income, blah, blah, blah. So they just fell into the cumulative health impact score pretty high, even without contamination, because of environmental justice issues. And then we have Magnolia, so the waterfront, really rich communities, and they have, you know, they had a score of 13. Okay. So now we're going to move on to policy. So this is the health impact assessment part. And for those of you who don't know health impact assessment, it's to examine the unintended health consequences of the cleanup of the Superfund site. So you can just imagine, like, why? It's counterintuitive. Why would you do a health impact assessment if you're cleaning up the contamination? But there was all these issues that a risk assessment or cleaning up the contaminated site hadn't addressed. For example, we have three environmental justice communities that are exposed to the Superfund site, and one of them was our Duwamish Valley residents. But they said, well, what about gentrification and we want to be revitalized? Like, how about what happens if all these people move in once the place is cleaned up, and then what if we can't afford to, you know, the taxes go up, et cetera, and we can't afford to stay here, so we're displaced? And then the other thing was the tribes and the non-tribal subsistence fishermen. The contamination is not going to be cleaned up. It's only going to be cleaned up. It's still going to be too contaminated for the tribes and subsistence people to eat. And so there's all these issues around that. Okay, now I'm going to move to action for the CARE project. And we had CARE, so what we did was we took all of those indicators and we developed all these GIS maps, and then we had these prioritization workshops where we went and met with the communities, and we said, hey, so here's all these maps, and here's all your priority, you know, here were all your issues, and we validated your issues by this research. Now where do you want to take action? And so they did a little sticky exercise, and they're interested in working on air pollution, crime and safety, and places to play. So we now have an RFP out to the local community organizations, and we use the priority workshops to develop action ideas. The bad news is we only have $50,000 to give to the communities. We had $250,000, but Congress cut the money. But they have to implement the action within 12 months. Now, just taking action at the community level is great, but we know that we have to take action upstream, so collaboration with multiple partners is super important, and we've been working actively with Public Health Seattle King County and King County, and then 70 or 80 different groups coming from all these other places like nonprofits, businesses, et cetera. So successes, challenges, and recommendations. So first of all, the three-pronged approach is synergistic. We shared work. We've been sharing resources. We've been reducing repetition, and we've been reducing competition between nonprofits. But one of the challenges is that sometimes information isn't shared. I'm not going to tell you who wasn't sharing information with us, but it was really frustrating because it just resulted in a ridiculous amount of repetition. And so, you know, our recommendation is trust building and follow the environmental justice definition. Meaningful involvement creates trust. Another One was communication between projects. So from a success point of view, we were able to communicate multiple pieces of information in fewer community settings because we have obviously huge community fatigue issues in these environmental justice communities. But one of the challenges was that there's still, even though we've got this three-pronged approach and we have all these partners, there's still some other projects going on outside of our three-pronged approach. And there was two surveys going on and the community got confused about the surveys. But my recommendation is to build in meeting times with other projects, make collaborative, you know, agreements between people, and then it really helps to have local government as a partner. And then the final success challenge recommendation was communication of health information. Combining community expertise with research to obtain data that the community wants was super successful. But the problem was when we were delivering information, they said, oh my God, this is so depressing. I'm going to go home and have a drink. I don't even know what to do with this information. You know, that's the type of stuff that they were saying. And I think what was really, really important in our community workshops, even though we emphasize this, I feel like we have to emphasize it even more. And the emphasis is that, you know, look, you have all these community assets. You guys are so amazing and so strong, and we are going to take action. We're going to take action at a community level. We have this $50,000, and we have all these other community partners. And the final one is about CBPR. So what was so extraordinary about using CBPR was how our community experts are amazing, and they were able to develop these ideas about health surveys and mapping their own community that we would have never thought of being out from outside of the community. And it was really powerful information, you know, presented in culturally competent ways. And it created money and jobs in the community. And it increased capacity and pride and empowerment to action. But it was time consuming, and they complained a little bit because we were trying to categorize some of our information into kind of social determinants of health domains. And they just said, don't do that. We want to do it our own way. So it was a great interaction of how to work with the community on how they wanted to present information. And the recommendation on that is that, you know, mentors are really, really important. And I've spent hours on the phone, you know, with the community-based CBPR experts just to give them confidence that what they're doing is right and excellent and I would recommend building it in, even though it's costly and time-consuming. It's totally worth it. That's it. These are context points, and I also want to acknowledge these people because they're part of the community-based participatory research team and also academic team that's helping us on a lot of this stuff. And that's it. Thank you so much for staying and listening.
Is basically about low-income minority communities being disproportionately exposed to environmental contamination, right? So that's the definition. So we wanted to, so when we picked the zip codes, we said, okay, so we want to pick low-income communities, but we also want high-income and middle-income, you know, as a reference of, you know, across the board that would go into the formula. And then same with minority communities, and we had some minority communities, well, I don't know, Seattle has a huge foreign-born population, more than 30 languages are spoken in the Duwamish Valley. So we also wanted to get like some zip codes where no one spoke, you know, everyone was, you know, born in the United States. So that was one range. Then we did the contamination range. And then most of the other indicators came from the CBPR survey. Does that make sense? And then actually what we did was we examined about 30 or 40 different indicators. And when we write our report, which is going to come out soon, there's an appendix with all of these. We have maps. We have about 30 maps, GIS maps, with each of these different indicators. But we only used 15 indicators for the cumulative health impacts analysis. And that was just based on a recommendation by Cal EPA. But I'll just have to tell you that when I plugged in all of them into the formula, the numbers didn't change, or the relative ranking didn't change. I mean, I fiddled, I did all these sensitivity analysis and fiddled with the formula, and it didn't matter. 98108, that Georgetown South Park zip code still came out at those, that high ranking. Yeah?
You were talking about, in one of your slides, about an assessment of the unintended consequences of
yeah.
the Superfund.
Yeah.
And I was struck, it sounded as if the residents of the communities along the river, as much as they wanted the Superfund to clean up the environment in which they were living their lives, were concerned that they would be displaced economically. How can one possibly address this? I mean, this sounds...
Well, thank you for that, and Bill, you can also speak up to this, too. So, I mean, so the point of the HIA is to then make recommendations to decision makers. And EPA is not our only decision maker. We've got people, potentially responsible parties, who are cleaning up the contamination. City of Seattle, King County, the Port of Seattle, and Boeing. So when we develop our recommendations, it's going to be like a matrix. So think of a matrix where we go to the EPA and we say, we recommend you do this. And King County, we recommend you do this. And then for King County and the City of Seattle, we're going to be saying, how about doing a policy where you freeze tax, you have like tax subsidies. But do you remember some of the others? We just had a meeting last week or the week before where we went to the community and we said, okay, now that we know that you're right, that gentrification will happen in the community, what do you want us to do? And so there was tax subsidies, there was affordable housing, can we build affordable housing? How do we clean up old contaminated housing? So they had all these ideas, and so we're going to put them together, and hopefully City of Seattle and King County will listen to us.
So no one
over there.
So no one was actually suggesting that the cleanup not occur because...
No.
It was a real mix. And people very much saw it as an opportunity.
Yeah, it's an opportunity.
The community and to build infrastructure and things that they always wanted to do, and saw it as a catalyst for stimulus.
Yeah. Yes?
So on the slides that they're going to be, is there a community benefits agreement that will come out of this activity?
I like that idea. Thank you for that suggestion.
Oh, yeah, you've got to put in community benefits agreement. If for no other reason than when they come in and do the cleanup, the impact on the community of the construction activities will lower air quality for great periods of time. All of that, the community should be into. That's the way we do it in San Francisco.
Thank you.
Okay. you have to also recognize that there's a greater burden on the community, and so you need a benefits package to go along.
Yeah, actually, that's a great suggestion. I mean, we're actively working on, just 2 weeks ago, we were doing a green jobs initiative, and so there'll be like more jobs given to people in the community
yes.
during the cleanup. So we're working on that. So maybe we're integrating some of that, maybe not calling it as the same semantics, but thank you so much. I'm going to definitely look that up and email you.
Call it that, and local hiring, if it's a community benefits package, you'll raise the percentage of.
Okay, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just to your point, we have the Community Reinvestment Act in Boston. Same thing happened in urban areas. The university's been in and bought up all the land. And now people who reside in neighborhoods abutting that land, their children can go to those universities and their costs. So it's all
that's amazing. That's an awesome policy idea. So I hope you're writing that down.
This is a sort of a larger question and a sort of a devil's advocate question. After seeing the OEHA Cali PA presentation probably just look at a map, talk with some local folks, and circle all the places, coast to coast, and just say, these are the EJ communities.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I really appreciate you bringing that up, because to me, the fact that we had to prove that, you know, the burden of proof is outrageous. It's outrageous that from an environmental perspective that we've had to do the burden of proof. And we wrote that into our grant when it was the EPA Environmental Justice Research Grant. We wrote that in, and we made the point. It was like, this is ridiculous. However, the city of Seattle and Kane County and all these people aren't even calling this community environmental community. We had to fight very, very hard to make, when we did the risk assessment further along the river, to make them do an environmental justice analysis, which, by the way, EPA finally did. It's the first environmental justice analysis on the Superfund site in the country, but we haven't even seen it yet. Meaningful involvement, EPA office did the analysis, but we haven't seen it.
Okay,
and
you weren't
going to
say
it
was.
I know, I'm sorry.
We knew.
But so anyway, your point is so important. But we feel at this point it gives us credibility, and so now it's going to go in, and people are going to take a look at it, be aghast, and hopefully, I think I'm supposed to be meeting with a group, a King County and City of Seattle people in the next few weeks to say, this is a reason to take action under your equity and social justice initiative. They have an equity and social justice initiative. Here is the proof. To take action.
Go ahead.
Also, a good tool is to get people who aren't real on board with the concept and look at the different parameters. Things that people never think about, like the percentage of Pumpleton parkland that's available, the percentage of tree canopy, and crime statistics. And I think it's really easy for people to just look things at a single hazard at a time and look at something.
Yeah. Go ahead, and then you and then you.
Actually, before we have any more questions, we have all the panelists up, and maybe have some broader questions. We have about 4 minutes left,
sure.
So I just want to make sure we have maybe any specific questions to follow them back.
So I'd just like to have a further discussion about what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you were looking at models to work with, did anyone consider PACE-DH? And if you decided not to, I'd like to know why.
We didn't consider it. Our whole project was very generic. It started with fighting the recommendation for another power plant in our neighborhood. Which is what got community members started on this whole process. We had no idea that we were an environmental justice neighborhood. We knew a lot of stuff was in our neighborhood. Nobody had ever connected the dots. Once the dots were connected, we put pressure on the Department of Public Health to support the community. They didn't have the dots connected. At first, they didn't support the community. Then when they looked at their data, they supported it. Then we did a survey. And then after we got more information, it was actually the doctors who said, you know what, we need to also do a toxic tour because we have gone through this process and we understand the impact on health. And so community members got together and we developed the program.
To answer, we didn't even consider it, not because we don't know it, but I just have to confess I was just super excited about the whole cumulative health impacts assessment that California had done, and it had, you know, it hadn't even been piloted yet, and I just wanted to, you know, propose this idea of piloting it and seeing what people thought of it and whether it works and how people respond, so, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Have you run into trouble with people who had lawsuits or potential lawsuits that did not cooperate or had their ulterior motives so that you had trouble getting coalitions together? Is that ever a problem?
Go ahead.
We didn't have problems with people who had lawsuits not wanting to be involved because the kinds of lawsuits that were pending were only helped by the work we were doing. it broadened people's understanding of what was going on in the community. And actually, one of the lead nonprofit organizations in our KEEP program sued our muni, our public transit, twice over exposure to PM. And if you know anything about city governments, you don't want to have one agency in the city being involved or supporting an activity with another agency being sued. But it was all focused toward cleaning up the, mainly cleaning up the air.
In terms of us at this point, I think that the only potential lawsuit that's going to happen is related to the Duwamish Superfund site, mm-hmm. and the fact that the tribes have sovereignty, and there's residual contamination after the cleanup, and so it wouldn't surprise me if we're in litigation sometime in the next 10 years.
I think we should take a question from the fellow who sits in the office next to mine.
The question relates to the last speaker, but I think it could relate to all of them. Take this in a contemporary context with Hurricane Sandy. You have a situation in New York City where there's a Kiwanis Canal Superfund site that is overflowing as we speak. And I was just wondering if anybody would care to comment on the porous nature of water and flooding that, say, torrential rains that can impact Superfund site, and how you would quantify some of the environmental justice issues in relation to the uncertainty of where the water is actually going to go.
Well, I mean, my response is I'd have to think about it, but, I mean, it's a really... Global climate change and flooding is a really significant issue with regard to environmental justice issues, and the Duwamish River Superfund site is a super interesting example because it's now straight, but the site used to be, a big bunch of oxbows, and contamination transport follows those oxbows, and so with global climate change, we're going to see, like, contaminant transport changing in that whole area, and it's something that's not being studied, and I could see how that could, you know, there could be some similar issues going on with that.
I don't know if this really addresses your question, but I know last year with Hurricane Irene, when we still had Healthy Homes grants in place in a lot of Massachusetts communities, the Healthy Homes grants enabled us to go into homes with community health workers after the storm to assess the damage. And there were funds available for mold remediation. There was a lot of asthma hospitalization after the storms just because of the level of mold and mildew exposure. And having those grants in place and being able to bring community health workers into the neighborhood and outside of the hospitals and into the homes to address those issues was a great resource. And so where we didn't have funds to fund health workers addressing asthma for families, we did have funds to address the buildings, the structural damage. Those grants are gone. I don't know how we're going to deal with the after effects of Sandy. Boston, kind of dodged a bullet on this one, but we still have a lot of residual damage, and it's still raining, and it's still flooding, and there's going to be a lot of mold, a lot of mildew, and asthma hospitalizations are going to be pretty high. So, I don't know. I'm scared.
So let me answer that with a different wrinkle, and that goes to the questions about gentrification and issues of gentrification. So in San Francisco, fortunately, knock on wood, although with climate change, who knows, it could change, but we don't have hurricanes. But we do have earthquakes.
Yes,
right, I know. We do have earthquakes, okay? And generally speaking, when we have a major earthquake, the most damage is done to some of the most valuable property in the city because it's the property that has the views and it's sitting down on the water.
Mm-hmm.
The city has lots of hills in their serpentinite, and so that bedrock
when you have an earthquake, it kind of goes like this. But when you're down there in the sand and you have an earthquake, it goes like this, and it can liquefy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So one of the things is that lots of people want to, more people want to move up onto the hills. And Baby Hunter's Point is one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. And it has a huge public housing, it's three public housing developments on that hill, and they have wonderful views of the bay. And wealthy people have been trying for years to figure out how they can move up on that hill, but it's San Francisco, and so we have this image that is not supported by the life we live, but we have this image that we can't just throw poor people out. Okay. So there have been lots of attempts to move folks out, and they are finally succeeding in having that occur through a number of things, but it's mainly redevelopment. So we've gone from a black community of about 12% in the late 90s to a black community in San Francisco of 3.8%. Mm. And the redevelopment agency just made that whole neighborhood a redevelopment project. And they have started building market rate housing on those hills as they tear down public housing under federal HOPE 6 projects. They are building, mixed income housing. Lots of it is going to be market rate and affordable, buying an affordable house in San Francisco, in my neighborhood, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods.
Wait for it.
Means $350,000. Okay. Now, we our poor people are in the $8,000 to $12,000 a year range, but if you want to buy a house in San Francisco and you want an affordable house, you have to be able to qualify for $350,000 or above. So gentrification is real, and using a number of ways of doing it, including cleaning up the neighborhood. You move people out. The city decided they were no longer going to contract for Section 8 vouchers. So every year we lose more Section 8. So when you move people away because you're cleaning up their neighborhood, you tell them they can come back, they have to move out of the city in order to use the Section 8 voucher that they get. You can't move back in.
I think we're out of time, but kind of good to stay around for a little bit longer if there's any questions. But is there a compliance sheet?